Sri Ishapanishad confirms that these pseudo-religionists are heading toward the most obnoxious place in the universe. After the completion of their spiritual master business, which they conduct simply for sense gratification. So then on to mantra 13, making the, like mantra, what was it, 10, the rather self-evident point that if you worship the Supreme, you get one result. If you worship something else, you get another result. So it's kind of self-evident. And it's extremely important to understand. As we mentioned, people, the foolish people nowadays, they don't understand. They think it's all one. That you worship Krishna or Durga or, you know, even some made-up god who doesn't even exist, not even like a demigod. Then they think it's all the same. One, in Bombay, there are many, the movie industry is based there in India. And many movie makers and actors and actresses come to our temple. And one devotee was telling me that one big film producer came to the temple and complained that I made a movie in which I created a fictitious demigoddess with some name or other. And there was a whole story about the hero worshipping the demigoddess and going through all sorts of trials and tribulations as they normally do, and coming out successful, and all glories to this fictitious demigoddess. So his complaint was that afterwards he found people opening temples to that demigoddess. And he was disappointed that they should have realized that it's just fictitious. So it's like that, you know. I mean, at worst, it can be like that, put it that way. People just get so sidetracked that it's completely crazy. The Aborigines in Australia, they worship the sun, which isn't, you know, too bad in one sense. But their worship, the idea behind the worship is that when the sun sets at night and then darkness comes, then what does it mean? Darkness has come. It means the sun's gone out. It's dead. So during the night, they worship the sun and they pray that the sun will be reborn the next day. Yeah. And so far, it's been happening like that. So, as far as we know, they take that to be evidence of the bona fidelity of the whole concept and the system of worship. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Just like... Yeah, just like the one man, have you, I don't know if you heard the story, about the one man who'd never seen a banana in his life. But when he was riding on a train somewhere, someone gave him a banana, and he looked at it with suspicion and said, wow, you know, is it safe? What is it? Is it safe or is it dangerous? And the other person said, no, it's okay, it's fine, it's good for you. Just eat it. So he peeled the banana, he was about to take his first mouthful, and the train entered a tunnel, and there was complete darkness. And he threw away the banana and said, wow, this is very dangerous. So, anyway, there's coincidence or, you know, certain factors in this material world. And if they're addressed in the wrong way, then you may end up with some phenomenon which appears to confirm a misconception. So, I mean, that in itself could be the subject of a course. But, yeah. Anyway, back to mantra 13, shall we say. So, yeah, we should worship the Supreme Cause and not anything else. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada is particularly stressing the bona fidelity of Krishna consciousness, and like the system of parampara, how bona fide, how authorized, how important it is to follow the real process if you want to actually come to this point of the supreme cause of all causes and be properly situated there. So you've got to really go about it the right way. So Prabhupada is stressing, like he mentions on page 93 up at the top, a person who buys a ticket for Calcutta can reach Calcutta, but not Bombay. Well, in India, anything could happen. But shall we say that is the principle, at least? You would normally expect that. Of course, he might buy a ticket for Calcutta and go nowhere. That would probably be more likely. The train would be cancelled, and they wouldn't give him a refund. So, you know, like the bona fidity of the whole thing is very important. You know, all the casual approach to spiritual life, it's really dangerous. The casual approach, terribly dangerous. So therefore, in this purport to 13, Prabhupada is stressing, I'm not going to go through all the details, but he's stressing the necessity of bona fidity, plus how Krishna consciousness conforms with the standard of bona fidity. So it is the process then for worshipping the Supreme Cause of all causes. How many of you read this mantra 13, like recently, with the purport? Any of you? Anyway, I would suggest, for the future reference at least, you read through these things the day before. There's a very interesting point which occurs on page 95, and it continues on through 96 and 97. It's very important just to note and observe and appreciate. Srila Prabhupada, having talked about the parampara and things like that, and how Krishna consciousness is in that line of disciplic succession, then, what was it, 95 you said? 95. Srila Prabhupada then starts to give Vedic evidences. Starting with, you see there, it's about a third of the way down page 95, he quotes the Atharva Veda, the Gopal Tapani Upanishad, which appears in Atharva Veda, substantiating that Krishna is the cause of all causes. Then he quotes the Narayana Upanishad a couple of times. You see that? Then he quotes again the Atharva Veda, the Maha Upanishad. And that's also substantiating that Krishna is the absolute truth. Then we turn over to 96, and right at the top, Prabhupada is quoting Moksha Dharma. Moksha Dharma is part of Mahabharata. Then he quotes, just a few lines further down, the Varaha Purana. Then further down, well, he quotes Brahma Samhita. He quotes Bhagavad Gita a little further down towards the bottom of the page. Then over onto 97, and at the beginning of that paragraph there in the middle of the page, he then quotes Vedanta Sutra. And then just a few lines further down, he quotes Srimad Bhagavatam. And, yeah. So, what's the point there? See, the point is, if you didn't grasp it, that Prabhupada is presenting the authority of Krishna consciousness. Here he's presenting the authority of Krishna consciousness in terms of the structure of the Vedic literatures, beginning with the Vedas, four Vedas, a few quotes from there, then the going into the Itihasas. Mahabharata is one of the Itihasas. Then into the Puranas with Varaha Purana. Then Vedanta Sutra, which comes after the Puranas. And then Srimad Bhagavatam. which comes after Vedanta Sutra and is the final level, the final triumph of the Vedic literatures. So the thing is, Prabhupada is doing it in this way because, in order to sort of appease or satisfy Vedic scholars, like real Vedic scholars. I mean real Vedic in the sense of being traditional Vedic scholars. You are all real Vedic scholars, but not in the sense of being very traditional and, you know, looking at the four Vedas and all the Vedas and how these things are structured. First from the Vedas, and then from the Itihasas, and then from the Puranas, and then from Vedanta Sutra. This is how you establish things in terms of traditional Vedic argument. Anyway, I found that interesting. I don't know if you did. Hope we're not putting anyone to sleep. So that's an interesting point. I find it very interesting. You know, Prabhupada's so intelligent. He's covering everything. He's giving so many clever arguments for fools and rascals like us who hardly know what the Vedas are about. So we become convinced. And then, you know, the big scholars, of course, they may not even be devotees, but at least they're sort of technically big scholars. He makes a very clever presentation for them to convince them. That's very nice. And then, mantra 14. So in mantra 13, it's established. Krishna is the cause of all causes. Krishna is that goal, that thing that must be worshipped. And anything other than Krishna is out, basically. In mantra 14, again, we talked about this yesterday, the main point. It is interesting to note in the purport of mantra 14, we're going a bit over time. Sorry about that. But it's interesting to note that in the purport, I mean, you can go through it and take out the examples yourselves if you want. How Srila Prabhupada is, in the purport, presenting, like, what are the most important points of transcendental knowledge, and what are the most important points about knowledge of nescience. He's taking out the most important points. The idea is that you should understand Krishna and his name, form, and qualities. You should understand the temporary creation with its temporary men, demigods, and animals. So Prabhupada is extracting very important points, basic points to understand about Krishna and about the material world, so that you get nicely fixed in this knowledge, which is essential if you're going to transcend the material nature. You get the idea? You sure? Positive? Okay. Any comments or questions? Okay. So we'll let you off for a few minutes, and we'll see you back shortly. Mantras 15, 16, 17, and 18. Everything is really going to build up to quite a climax here, actually, for a book which is so, like, brief and to the point and so philosophical. The speaker really manages to manifest a very intense mood of transcendental feeling here in these last verses. They're very, very nice. So let us chant these verses, starting with mantra 15 on page 109. Hiranmayena patrena satyasya pihitam mukam tatvam pushana pavrino satya dharmaya drishtaye. O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. Mantra 16, page 117. We have a tricky little last line again. Pushane karshe yama surya prajapatya.
Pushane karshe yama surya prajapatya.
Vyuha rajman samuha. Tejo yate rupam kalyana tamam.
Tejo yate rupam kalyana tamam.
Tatepas yami yo savaso purusha sohamasmi. O my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays, so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal, supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun, as am I. Mantra 17, page 123. Vayur anilam amritam.
Vayur anilam amritam.
Ate dambas mantam shariram.
Ate dambas mantam shariram.
Om krato smara kritam smara.
Om krato smara kritam smara.
Krato smara kritam smara.
Krato smara kritam smara.
Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I have done for you. Mantra 18, page 133. Agne naya supata raya yasman. Vishvani deva vayunani vidvan. Yuyod yasmaj juhuranam eno. Puyishtam te nama uktim vidhema. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, O omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all that I have done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so that there will be no hindrance to my progress. These very beautiful verses, the speaker having been very philosophical and sober, serious, you know, in that sort of mood. But now, he is really speaking from his heart. As you can make out, I would assume, from Mantra 17, actually, the speaker is at the time of death. He's at the time of death. So, he knows that, you know, I don't have any more chance, as we mentioned the other day, I won't get another chance. Just like this morning, you may have missed Mangalarati. How many of you missed Mangalarati, either by just not getting up at the temple or not having a Mangalarati at all? Oh, you all were there. Okay, so it doesn't apply to you. That's some really great devotees here. I'm very fortunate. Well, I am very fortunate. Anyway, he's got no, he can't say that, well, you know, I didn't make it today, you know, I just was tired or whatever, I couldn't get up. But tomorrow I'll be there. No, when the time of death comes, you just, as they say, got to put your chips on the table. They say that, don't they? I heard someone say that once. That's it. That's it. You're there. You know, you can't sidestep anything. No clever talk about, you know, why you didn't finish your rounds. It's all there. It's all on the table. And you just, you know, All you can do, really, ultimately, is as he's doing, just pray for some mercy. Please be kind. Now, you can't get up and say, look, you know, I'm really qualified, and just take that into consideration, okay? You can't say that. You just got to be very humble and plead for some mercy, some help. And this is what he's doing. Mantras 15 and 16 are interesting. One interesting point, at least, is that he is saying in both verses that I want to see your face, but I can't because of the Brahma Jyoti, the dazzling effulgence. I can't see your face. In both verses, again, it's a repetition. I want to see your face. I want to meet you. I want to have your personal association. So please be kind. Remove that dazzling effulgence. The thing is, the Brahma Jyoti, of course, is the effulgence of Krishna's body. None of us are God, so we are not effulgent like that. But Krishna, he's so effulgent. He is so effulgent that unless you have certain qualifications, if you look at Krishna, as this devotee is saying here even, you'll just see this dazzling effulgence. Because he's so effulgent. Sometimes devotees are effulgent. As I look around here, I see Ananda's effulgent. Who else? Oh, Lokabandhu is very effulgent. And, yes, anyway, you're all generally pretty effulgent. So depending on how Krishna conscious a person is, they may well be quite effulgent. This happens. So even sometimes when we're out on Sankirtan, sometimes, particularly like in Europe or America where it's just materialistic people, then the devotees have to disguise themselves, put on wigs sometimes, or at least one of these little woolly hats, and, you know, wipe off their tilak and hide the neck beads, put on kami clothes, so the people won't understand that this is a Hare Krishna devotee, because sometimes they have negative feelings about Hare Krishna. So the devotees do that, but sometimes the problem arises that the devotee is there, you know, all heavily disguised, distributing books, and gives someone the book, and they don't even look at the book to see it's a Hare Krishna book, but they're just looking at the devotee and say, hey, you're a Hare Krishna. And the devotee's trying to be disguised and undercover. The devotee says, no, 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 not me. The what? Hare what? No, no, you got the wrong person. And they say, no, you're Hare Krishna, I can tell. No, I'm not. I'm not. Who, me? Hare Krishna? No way. Then they say, no, I know you're Hare Krishna, because you're shining. You're shining. So it can be difficult. There's one funny incident. I mean, really nice incident, actually. In New York in 1976, when Prabhupada attended the Ratha Yatra, some of you may have heard this story before, that Prabhupada, there was one devotee, few devotees standing there by the Rath cart just waiting for the festival, for the parade to begin, and the New York police were there to assist with the traffic control and all that. So the New York cops, for those of you who've been to New York, you'd know what a New York cop is like, where they're like the real thing. They're the real thing. They're not like our cops. You know, our cops, they're just a bunch of sissies. But the New York cops, boy, I tell you what, they're such heavy guys. They're super heavy. I saw them one time, we were driving along on a big wide road coming into New York from the suburbs, And there were some cops in a car on the one side, like 5 or 6 lanes across on each side. And they were on the one side, and they spotted right on the other side some bad guys, some of the crooks. So they just turned on all their sirens, and boy, I tell you, their sirens sounds like an ear raid, like 10 ear raid warnings, something like that. Screaming sirens, lights flashing, everything, and just came roaring through 6 lanes of traffic like it practically wasn't there. Leapt out of the cars, just ripped the doors of the other car open, threw the guys out on the road, picked them up, just hurled them over their own car, and started smashing them and going through their pockets. And these poor crooks, you know, they were completely finished. Anyway, they're real tough guys. But they're also very nice guys. I mean, in their own way, being New Yorkers are kind of very intriguing people like that. So anyway, there were the devotees and the rough cut and a couple of New York cops. I mean, I think to be a New York cop, the minimum you've got to be like 6'4" and weigh about 100 kilos. That's the minimum before they'll consider you. So, you know, these big, solid guys and kind of like rough guys. So there, everyone's waiting. Then Srila Prabhupada arrives. Prabhupada arrives, devotees offer their obeisances. Prabhupada just gets out of the car, and there he is, you know. He's just been there a few seconds. And the New York cops are just hanging around. And then they saw Prabhupada, one of them saw Prabhupada, and he grabbed his friend and said, "Hey, look at that guy. He's glowing." Yeah, they really appreciate it. "He's glowing." So Prabhupada, because he was very Krishna conscious, he was really effulgent. He would just glow sometimes. One of our devotees was telling me just a couple of weeks ago that he was in San Francisco and he met one person who had been on the Morningstar Ranch. Any of you who are a little familiar with Prabhupada's pastimes would remember the Morningstar Ranch. Remember that place? The description? It was they generally didn't wear clothes, hippies, and they didn't wear clothes very much. But Prabhupada went there and did a program. Anyway, so some of them became devotees, and some of them almost did, but didn't quite. But they remained favorable. So this one devotee was telling me, just a couple of weeks ago, that he met one of the people who had been there, and who had not become a devotee really, but remained favorable. And he was asking about Srila Prabhupada. And this fellow said, he's like an old hippie now, he's 55 or something like that. He said, yeah, I remember the Swami. He was a real cool cat. So I don't know how we got onto that, but the thing is that the devotee here in mantras 15 and 16, he is appealing to the Lord, "Please remove your effulgence, because I want to see you." And the devotee feels like this. Krishna is so effulgent. Depends on your state of consciousness, how you see Krishna. Like when Krishna entered the arena, in the wrestling arena in Mathura, when he killed Kamsa, then the arena was full of all different types of people. They all saw Krishna differently. The sort of mature men and ladies who were already parents, they saw Krishna and Balaram as being delicate little boys. And they were feeling, this is most extremely unfair. These little boys meant to fight these big wrestlers, this is terrible. Then the young ladies, sort of like teenage girls, something like that, they saw Krishna and Balaram as very beautiful, very handsome young fellows, like that. Then the wrestlers, Mushtika and Chanura, they saw Krishna and Balaram as death. something quite different. Death personified. Then there were some So when they saw Krishna and Balaram walking across the arena, they saw these two Vishnu forms with four arms, with the carrying the club and the conch and lotus and chakra. And then there were some impersonalists, and what did they see? They saw these two lights moving across. That's a fact. It's described in Srimad Bhagavatam very clearly. So the thing is that you see Krishna according to your consciousness. Actually, none of those perceptions were incorrect. You couldn't say that, you know, the mature men and ladies who saw Krishna and Balaram as little boys, that was wrong. But that, you know, any one of the others was right. You couldn't say that. They're all right. They're all right, but it just depends on your perspective or your condition, actually. So, the pure devotee will see Krishna, but the non-devotee will see something else. Death, maybe. Or time, or something horrible. Or nothing, even. So the pure devotee wants to see Krishna, and that is explained here in 15 and 16. And the speaker is appealing. He is referring to the Lord, or addressing the Lord. In 15 he says, O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives. Then in 16 he says that you are the primeval philosopher, the maintainer of the universe, the regulating principle, the destination of the pure devotees, and what is it? The well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind. So an interesting point is that these particular features of the Lord, these are all features of the Lord, basically, in which he's very merciful. He's sustaining everyone, well-wisher of the devotees, like this, maintainer of the universe. He's very merciful in these forms. So the speaker is appealing to him in these merciful forms, that I want to see you, I want to meet you personally. This is the desire of the devotee. This is the desire. The devotee wants to see Krishna. Not in a cheap sense, but in the sense out of love. After all, we're serving Krishna. We're dedicating, trying to dedicate our lives to Krishna and do everything 24 hours a day for Krishna. So we'd like to see Krishna, actually. We would definitely like to see Krishna. That would be very nice. Then Mantra 17, he sort of changes the theme a little bit, just a little bit. I mean, the main theme remains, that I want you. Please give me mercy. Give me mercy so I can come to you personally. But here he makes it very clear that he's at the point of death. And he's saying, just let this body be burned up. It doesn't matter. Just take this body. But please, I want to come to you. And he's asking, please remember all my sacrifices. Now you might say that, you know, isn't it a little selfish? It's like, at the critical moment, you're putting in a plug for yourself. A little advertisement. Self-advertisement. But I mean, let's give him a break. When you're at the time of death, I mean, you just got to do something like that. Make some sort of appeal. Please, somehow, do something, anything, but just help me, please, to reach you. Please remember all my sacrifices. Remember all I've done for you. So, the purport here is interesting in that Prabhupada makes the point, it's kind of like a fairly obvious point, Prabhupada makes one very interesting point which isn't very obvious. It's like a technical point, but I thought I'd bring it to your attention. It's on page 127. Prabhupada's talking here on page 127 about how at the time of death you tend to remember whatever you've done, and then your next life, whatever you've done throughout your whole life. And then your next life tends to be formed based on that, your remembrance of all the various things you've done. Prabhupada says, though, in the bottom paragraph there, unlike the simple animals who have no developed mind, the dying human being can remember the activities of his life, like dreams at night. Therefore, his mind remains surcharged with material desires, and consequently, he cannot enter into the spiritual kingdom with a spiritual body. Interesting point, isn't it? The animals, they are not really thinking very much. So when the time of death comes, they can't really remember what they've done. It's kind of blank. But humans, oh, they remember so many things. Their minds are full of all the impressions gathered over the years. And therefore they remember that at the time of death, and they go to that. The devotees, however, develop a sense of love for Godhead by practicing devotional service to the Lord. Even if at the time of death a devotee does not remember his service, the devotee here is appealing to the Lord that you please remember. Even if the devotee doesn't remember his service, the Lord does not forget him. This prayer is given to remind the Lord of the devotee's sacrifices. But even if there is no such reminder, the Lord does not forget the service rendered by his pure devotee. Then Prabhupada quotes Bhagavad Gita chapter 9 verses 30-34. Krishna is saying there, they're very important verses, particularly in 30, Apichet Sudaracharo Bhajate Mama Nanyabak. Krishna is saying that even if my devotee performs some abominable activity, very terrible activity, then, but if, as long as he remains engaged in devotional service, then he must be considered saintly. A sadur eva. He must be. It's an emphatic. Eva means certainly, definitely. Must be considered a sadhu. And because he's properly situated in his determination, and then he quickly becomes righteous in fact, even though now he may not be righteous. So Krishna is extremely kind, extremely kind. This is one of the main points being brought out here in this whole sequence of verses in the section. The devotee is appealing, please be kind, please help me. And Prabhupada is explaining very nicely that Krishna will be kind and he will help. Even if the devotee becomes a little bewildered at the time of death, which wouldn't be too surprising, but Krishna will remember everything and help. And in order to, you know, establish that point very clearly, Prabhupada's quoting these verses. You know, of course, what happens to a person who normally performs sudur-achar, abominable action. They go to hell. Normally, they go to hell. There are 28 or so different types of hells. You can choose which one you want to go to, in the sense that if you choose a certain action, you'll go to a certain hell. So, you know, normally if you do sudur-achar, Prabhupada translates that as abominable. That really means extremely bad. So you go to hell, normally. That's the normal program. But if you're a devotee, and you stick at it, as long as you don't give up, do your sudur-achar, your abominable activity, and then give up Krishna consciousness and go away. That's another thing. Krishna says, mrityu samsara sagarat. Such a person returns to the ocean of birth and death. But the devotee who hangs in there, despite the problems, the weaknesses, and even the fall downs, and sticks there at Krishna's lotus feet somehow or other, then what happens to them, even if they do sudur-achar, do they go to hell? No. No. They're saints. they're saintly and you must regard them as such, and they'll quickly become righteous. Krishna, our acharyas, in commenting on verse 31, in which Krishna says they quickly become righteous and attain lasting peace, our acharyas make the point that Krishna is using the present tense, which means they, you know, very quickly, it's like, it's almost now that they come right. So, by his mercy. Then Srila Prabhupada quotes bottom of page 128, going over onto 129. He quotes Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary on these verses. And it's a very interesting commentary. So interesting, I thought that I would, if you bear with me, read the whole thing. It's just that one paragraph. So he says, one should regard a devotee of Krishna to be on the right path of the saints, even though such a devotee may seem to be sudur achar, a person of loose character. One should try to understand the real purport of the word sudur achar. A conditioned soul has to act for double functions, namely, for the maintenance of the body, and, again, for self-realization. Social status, mental development, cleanliness, austerity, nourishment, and the struggle for existence are all for the maintenance of the body. The self-realization part of one's activities is executed in one's occupation as a devotee of the Lord. And one performs actions in that connection also. One must perform these two different functions along parallel lines. The proportion of activities for maintenance of the body decreases, however, in proportion to the increase in devotional service. As long as the proportion of devotional service does not come to the right point, there is a chance for an occasional exhibition of worldliness. But it should be noted that such worldliness cannot continue for long, because, by the grace of the Lord, such imperfections will come to an end very shortly. Therefore, the path of devotional service is the only right path. If one is on the right path, even an occasional occurrence of worldliness does not hamper one in the advancement of self-realization. So, on a practical level, we should be tolerant with sincere devotees who are struggling and not too quick to condemn them. Yeah, and then if we get into a similar situation, we may get the same mercy. But if we try to be too heavy with neophyte devotees who are struggling and sometimes failing in their struggle, if we're too intolerant with them, then we may get some intolerance back. So anyway, then we go on to mantra 18. Here he's really bringing it to the finale, so to speak. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, O omnipotent one, you can do it. You're omnipotent. You can do it. You can save me. Now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all that I've done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so that there'll be no hindrance to my progress. So again, he's throwing himself on the ground. It's the final appeal, right at the lotus feet of the Lord. No shame. I mean, not feeling embarrassed to throw himself on the ground, just throwing himself at the feet of the Lord, begging for mercy. And the Lord is so merciful. He's extremely kind. So he'll do that. He'll protect the devotee. You know, there's the one nice story of Vibhisan. You may have heard us tell it before. That Vibhisan was Ravana's brother, but he didn't like Ravana. He was actually a good person and a devotee. So he left Ravana. and went to join Lord Ram, who at that time was busy building the bridge to Lanka. So Vibhishan came flying in, and who was it? Sugriva saw him, yeah. And Sugriva told Lord Ram, look, here comes Vibhishan, watch out, he's a demon, we'll kill him as soon as he lands. And Lord Ram said, well, you know, wait a minute, he's just one man. And you know, you never know. To give him a chance, we'll meet with him and speak with him and we'll see. Maybe, you know, maybe he's coming to join us or something like that. And Sugriva was saying, no. He's a demon. We'll kill him as soon as he lands. We'll just jump on him and that'll be that. The only good demon is a dead demon. Ask, what is it? Bash first, ask questions later. That sort of thing. Get him with the clubs. You know. That would be the end of Vibhishan. But Lord Ram was saying, no. Just wait and see what he has to say. So Sugriva was there with Hanuman, and you know, they are ready for action. And Vibhishan landed and came and offered his obeisances to Lord Ram. And everyone was thinking, gosh, that's strange, he's a demon. They don't normally do things like that. So, and Lord Ram was being very nice with him and warm like that. And Sugriva came and said, look, you know, he's just acting. It's just an act. Just let us kill him. Then we don't have to worry about him. And then Lord Ram got very angry with Sugriva and told him that, you just be quiet. You be quiet. And Vibhishan was telling Ram, I want to join you. I want to join your army and be your follower. And Sugriva was saying, no, please don't listen to him. Lord Ram got very angry. And then he told Sugriva, he made a statement, very nice statement, which appears in Nectar of Devotion and a few other places, quoted by Srila Prabhupada. So it's an important statement. Lord Ram told him that even if Ravan himself came and said he wanted to surrender to me, I would immediately accept him. Immediately. And any person who comes to me and tells me that, my Lord, from this day on, I'm yours, that I never forget that person. So Krishna is very kind to the devotees. Even if the devotees then continue on, they're trying, but they fall down sometimes and get confused sometimes and make mistakes sometimes and they're struggling, but he remembers and he helps his sincere devotees. He helps. And as the speaker is saying, that you please lead me on the right path, the implication there says, lead me on the right path to reach you. Since you know what I've done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins so that there'll be no hindrance to my progress. Even if I have to take birth again because of my past sins, then you please lead me on the right path so there'll be no hindrance. So one way or another, I can come to your lotus feet by your mercy. So that is the end of Sri Ishapanishad. That is the end of the course. Grantharaj Sri Ishapanishad Kirtan.